I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Ryan Weiss. He is the head of Effective Performance Strategies. But this wasn't his first business. He founded and ran his first business from ages 15 to 20 to pay for college. That company is still running. It's being run by his little brother, and it serves thousands of clients in over 50 communities. And he took a big detour through corporate America, worked for, well, maybe corporate Germany would be the better term. He worked for a big German company that took him all over the world, except for apparently Germany, which is interesting. Look forward to learning more about that. And then he came back. When they tried to move him to Germany, he moved back to Chicago and founded Effective Performance Strategies in 2016. The company has since grown to a global team serving clients from a wide variety of industries in North America. The industries include construction services, transportation, manufacturing, and others. And he has a proprietary software platform, a BPO team. We're going to get him to define what BPO is. That's one of those confusing terms. I think it means business process outsourcing. And a facilitation coaching team. Ryan, welcome.
Thank you, Craig. Pleasure to be on your podcast today.
Well, I've been looking forward to it. You know, we first connected months ago, and I think we were going to record this a little bit earlier, but you were off in someplace exotic, apparently also not Germany. And so we rescheduled and we landed here today.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I may have been on a sailing or coming back from a sailing trip, and that was a great experience. But we weren't able to record it during my trip back, but I'm glad that we're able to talk today.
So I gotta ask, what's the aversion to Germany? Every time somebody tries to send you to Germany, you like run away.
Well, I mean, with a last name like Weiss, right? I mean, that's the heritage. I have spent time in Germany, traveled there for business trips, but I worked for a big German chemical company, and they moved us to Asia and back to the United States twice. And the last time they were moving us back to the States, my wife and children were all in the Philippines. We were living in the Philippines. They flew me to Germany. They're like, "All right, here's the job. You know, we want you to come to Germany." And I said, yes. And then I called my wife and I said, "Are we really doing this? Like, we moved 7 times in 17 years and our children are getting a little bit older." And it's like, you know, we wanted them to be by their cousins and friends. Like, Germany would have been an amazing experience too, but just ultimately decided it was time to become entrepreneurial again, come back by family and take a different direction.
Where in Germany would you have moved to?
It would have been Dusseldorf.
I've been there. I think I've been there once. Yeah. There's a place not far away called Kempelenfort, if I remember correctly. It was a small little town, but it played a historic role at the end of the war. And the Philippines, where did you live in the Philippines?
So we lived just south of Manila. Our office was in Makati in like the downtown business district. And we lived in Ayala Alabang, which is about 30 minutes south if you take the Skyway, or 4 hours if you take the regular roads.
Isn't that insane? I mean, people complain about driving in the U.S. And so the Skyway, is that the monorail that shoots across town?
No, it's actually just like an elevated expressway. So, I exaggerate a little bit, but if you go on the Skyway, there was literally an entrance ramp right outside of our village, and an exit ramp literally just down the street from our office. And so I could get on the Skyway, but it was expensive. I mean, it was $4 each way every day. And and so almost all of the local people would go on the road below it, and it'd be hours oftentimes to get that 20 or 30 miles, probably 20 miles.
Yeah. And I mean, so a little bit of bearing for those that have never been to Manila. Makati is the business district. It's very clean, very pristine, very nice. I claim that there's this god named Makati that blows a special breeze on there because it just feels more comfortable there than it does in the rest of Manila.
That is fair.
And the other thing is the traffic is really like nothing you've ever seen. I mean, if you saw the Mission Impossible, or no, it was the one of the Bourne movies where, you know, the guy was racing across Manila, guy across Manila in, you know, 10, 15 minutes. I'm like, that was no part of Manila that I was ever in.
No. And I mean, the people there are amazing. We loved our experience there, but the traffic is absolutely a huge challenge. And Makati is a very nice, you know, very nice area for office buildings and stuff like that. So
did you make it to the Taal volcano?
So we lived about halfway between. So yeah, there's a lake inside a volcano inside a lake inside a volcano. And there's some pretty cool stuff. I mean, it's an interesting experience, a cultural experience to live there.
Yeah. Well, probably real close to where you lived was one of the scenes from the movie Apocalypse Now. You know, when they're flying the helicopter, to take the captain in, they're actually flying over Manila Bay, not far from where you live.
Not too far, yeah. I'm gonna have to watch that movie. I don't think I've ever seen it, so I'll have to watch it now.
Yeah. So you lived there and you lived in Singapore. What was Singapore like?
Did Singapore is it's like living in Disney World. It's illegal to sell chewing gum, right? Because they keep it so clean. It is so clean, so safe. You know, it's really like living in a different world. And we lived there for a couple of years. Our three oldest children went to school there in their very early years. And that was a very different experience. So we never owned a car in Singapore. We, you know, always took public transportation, taxi, like very, very clean, very safe, and a very different experience for sure.
Wow. So anybody that's lived in Asia has one of these just crazy stories of something that happened to them. And over there, it makes perfect sense. But when you tell people back here, this happened, they looked at you and they're like, who are these people?
Well, you know, the story for me is the first time I traveled to China, we went to a restaurant that was called, the loose translation was called the Fisherman's Wharf or something like that. And it was this massive restaurant, the biggest restaurant I've ever been in my life. And the top floor was tables and these rooms, you know, private rooms, tables. And like the main floor were just fish tanks with, it looked like I walked into National Geographic, right? You know, alligators and sea creatures that just I, you know, never seen before. And so we went to our table, you get this little coupon book and you go around downstairs and just like point at things and give them, and your coupon book had the table number. And so by the time we got back upstairs, the, you know, whatever stuff you had pointed to was prepared and brought to the table. And so they just kept bringing different things up. And one of my colleagues, I'll just never forget this. And this was my first trip to China. He said he grew up poor. And there was a saying in Cantonese that translated would be something like, we eat everything in the ocean but the rocks, everything in the air but the plane, and everything on the table but the plate. And so I made an agreement with him on that very first trip to China. I was living in Singapore. I'm like, I know I'm coming back. I said, I will try anything that you eat, with one exception, right? I'm like, you ever bring a live monkey out to the table? Like, yeah. Scalding oil, that stuff. Like, I just don't need that in my life. So, but I said, I'll try anything that you eat. And because of that one decision, I ate just some crazy foods, sea worm jelly and just some really, really strange stuff over the years. The sea worm jelly was literally like some, it was like jelly, but with worm guts in it. It's hard to describe, but it's easy to describe. It's hard to imagine.
So here's the important question. When they were bringing any dish out, did he ever clench his fist and say, it's good for men?
I don't remember saying that, but.
Because if you're in Asia and they say something's good for men, they're bringing it on a plate, you're about to see the most nasty thing you've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was like, you know, they bring out these things, pig part soup and stuff like that. And I'm like, which part, right? And it's like, yeah, there is lots of intriguing things there.
Well, of course, in the Philippines, balut is good for men.
Balut. Well, when I moved to the Philippines, all of my employees, I had 180 team members that worked for me there. And they all wanted me, they wanted to know if I was going to try balut while I was living in the Philippines. And I said, well, so I set, this was the wisest thing I ever did. I didn't realize it at the time, but I set these really high targets, performance targets. And I said, if any of the teams hit the target that I've set, which was like really stretched target, then I'll try balut. And I had two teams come up to me, two of the team managers and a couple of people from their teams in my last week in the Philippines. And they said, are you going to try balut? And I said, oh, did you hit the target? And they said, we got really close. And I said, well, I got really close to trying balut.
Good for you. Good for you. It's nasty. I tried once. I couldn't get past sucking the juice. Yeah. It's just too nasty. Well, cool. Well, so anyway, well, that's really interesting. And so I kind of veering into, somewhere in here was work. And so you're working for this German company. And what did you learn working? So the German company was Henkel, not the knife company. What did you learn working for Henkel that then translated to what you're doing now?
Yeah, so I learned a ton. And I learned about, I got my degrees in chemistry and finance. I think when we first, before the recording, we talked a little bit about how, you were like, well, you're a very systems thinker and process and all this stuff. And in Germany, that's like, it's systems and process, right? But the thing that I really learned.
Hey, let me pause you right there. So I used to have Siemens as a customer, and the company I was working for made a lot of mistakes. And my boss one day told me, they would make the mistakes, I would tell the Germans. That was the deal. I don't know how I got the short end of the stick, but that was the deal. I had to explain when things went wrong, I had to go tell the Germans what happened. And no kidding, one day my boss said, go tell them we were leaning forward in our saddles because we knew where they wanted to be. And, we were just leaning forward in our saddles and we missed. And I was like, one, I don't think cowboy analogies work on the Germans. Two, all they're going to hear is we had a documented process that we abandoned and something broke. And they're going to say, of course it broke. You abandoned your documented process.
That's exactly right. So I'm a process guy, right? Like chemistry and finance. How much more systematic can you get than that? And I worked in a German company. But probably the biggest thing that I learned was the process is only effective if people use it and people follow it and people engage with it and people work on improving it. If not, we're all just like cogs in a wheel, just doing a process, but lots of bad things happen. Even when everybody follows the process, the department, handoffs between departments get broken, things like that. And then how do you deal with that? If when things don't go the way the process is supposed to go, people have to step in and you have to have a framework for enabling people to be successful. That's really the key purpose of process. And that's probably the biggest thing that I learned was it's not all about process. It, process is important to the extent that it enables people to do something effectively, efficiently, that enables them to solve problems. And that became really the core learning that I've built my current company on.
You know, I'm literally reading a book right now where the author of the book literally shut down his company for a month to document all their processes. They made checklists for everything. And like 6 or 12 months later, everything was breaking. And he looked in and he was like, well, what's happening? Nobody was using the checklists.
Yeah.
So that's so key. It's what you're saying is, yes, a process is important, but only if people put it to work. So what's the key? What'd you learn to making sure that people use the processes that were in place?
Yeah. So the biggest thing that I've learned is that processes need to be practical implementation. Sitting in a boardroom and writing out what you think people should do. And maybe part of the challenge that he had in that case was he shut down his business. So instead of creating processes while observing how people actually behave, how people actually do things, they created hypothetical or theoretical processes of what they think should happen. And often what I find is most process organizations or most process consultancies, software, things like that, they focus on how does a role do what they're supposed to do? How does a person do what they're supposed to do? What are the steps that they need to take? The bigger thing that I see, you know, time after time with companies is that the biggest problem is not a person's ability to do a simple task or a standardized task, I'll say, that they do every day. The biggest challenge is when they get information handed off. So yesterday was the Super Bowl, right? You got to have good handoffs. When they get the wrong information or they don't get the information they need, or they, that lack of a handoff between departments, between people, between systems, that's where processes break down. Organizations go out and they write all these processes for each role and each position and each person, but the breakdowns don't happen because, like, if you have somebody who's been in their role for 5 years, they know exactly how to process those invoices. They know exactly how to make that batch of adhesive or whatever they're producing. The problem is if they don't get the information that they need to do their job, then they can't follow their process and they've got to go off and do something, you know, something completely different. So it's those handoffs that became the thing that we built Optics around, is solving the problem of handoffs between people, between departments, between sometimes between customers and vendors and things like that. It's really about the handoffs that happen.
So help me understand this. Any business owner wants to run a business where he could lose his most valuable employee at any point and the business still runs. And so that requires documentation. But then it's implementation. How, you know, you pointed out that the person I was referring to, you know, sat down, did documentation without seeing how it actually worked. How do you thread that needle to make sure that you have everything documented? So if somebody were to leave suddenly or die suddenly, I mean, that's certainly part of my story. I almost checked out. Well, I did check out for 6 weeks unexpectedly, where the experts thought I wasn't coming back. And so how do you thread that needle?
Yeah. So typically with clients, I've got a five-step process. The first thing is, we don't start with documenting a process that a person does. What we do is we create something, and I'm going to use a wonky acronym here, but we use a framework or a picture called a SIPOC. And that acronym stands for suppliers, inputs, process, outputs, and customers. And I first learned about this tool back when I was taking the Dale Carnegie training. I didn't learn about it from Dale Carnegie. I learned about it at the same time that I was taking Dale Carnegie training. And it is the most powerful tool that I've found. And it's very, very simple to take people through and look at what are the key steps of this process? What inputs do you need to make your process work? What outputs do you create from your process? And who needs those outputs? And then what are those inputs and who supplies those inputs to you? So the first thing we start with is it takes us 60 to 90 minutes to kind of put this map together. And while going through that with a client, I can very quickly zero in on these are the outputs you're not getting. And that's why your process is broken. This is the process step you're struggling with to do consistently. These are the people who are frustrated because they're not getting you the stuff that you need. These are the people, these are the departments or people that are frustrating you in your process. And that 60 to 90 minutes sets the framework for everything else that we do, because it's not just about process. It's about people and process. And that's the gap that almost all organizations miss when they're trying to document process. They document process and they forget about the people. So that suppliers and customers and process, those three things together is where the intersection happens. And that's where the pain is happening in most organizations.
Now, most business leaders are going to like slam their fist on the table and say, I care about my people. I listen to my people, but there's still a gap. What's the cause of that gap? What's the blind spot?
The blind spot is that you've got to intersect people and process. You can hire Dr. W. Edwards Deming, right? He's a quality guru from decades ago. The quote on his website, I think up until today, I haven't checked it today, but is a bad system will beat good people every time. A bad system will beat good people every time. So you can love your people and hire in the best people. And I had a CEO actually of a company a couple of years ago. He said, our problem is not our process. Like our problem is that our people aren't really motivated and they're not engaged. And so I said, oh, do you hire people who are disengaged and not interested in working for your company? Are those the types of people you hire? And it went silent just like that, right? No, he would go out and recruit and hire talented people, but his team had become frustrated and, you know, people without good processes. You've got to do both. And so a lot of times process consultants, they focus on process and they're like, all right, how are we going to solve your process problems? You have people consultants, you're like right people in the right seats and bringing in the right people, recruit the right people for your culture, all these things. You've got to blend these two things together. And that SIPOC tool, that SIPOC framework, I haven't counted them, but it's well over 1,000 by this point in my life. And I've done them in Mandarin Chinese through translators. And that CEO of that company looked at me and said, you now understand my business better than my people, right? Mm-hmm. That was after an hour and a half meeting with this guy. The thing is that understanding the intersection of people and process is the thing that I see organization after organization struggle with. And we've got some simple steps and frameworks for helping people to solve it.
That's very cool. Now, a term you used a few minutes ago was optics. What's optics? What's it mean? Why do we care?
Yeah. So optics, I stumbled upon this word about 2.5 years ago. I was like, I've got this system, I've got all these ideas. The word optics has two definitions, and it encapsulates the things I was just talking about. The first definition that a lot of people think about, you know, glasses and the study of light and maybe physics, right? Or a gun, you know, the sights on a gun or things like that. Very technical things about focus and all these technical parts of the study of light. But there's a second word of optics, and the second word or second definition, I should say, which is the perception of people about a situation, the perception of a situation. You might say, what do the optics of that situation look like? How would people perceive it? And it's used in politics or in, you know, sometimes in companies as they're thinking about, you know, spending money or buying things or investing. So it has these two meanings. One of them is about this very technical stuff of process. And one of them is about the perceptions of people. And it's that intersection that I am so passionate about, of helping people and process come together in a practical way that people will actually do. Because if it's not practical, nobody's doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so key. I mean, that's so incredibly key. And it's one of the things I heard you say a few minutes ago was, when you're building these processes, you have to do it with the people. You know, if you're sitting in an ivory tower and you hand things down, I mean, think about any of us. Think about any of us. When we have a hand in the development of it, we own it. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, I mean, I help folks with marketing. And one of the things I've learned is, if I want people to take, you know, my advice, the best way is if they think it's their advice.
I have a patent. I have a patent that I got very early in my career with a customer. And it's a joint patent. My name's on the patent between our company and the client's company. And the thing that clicked in my brain, I was reading about, I forget who it was. I think it was Carnegie and Henry Ford. Carnegie had a locomotive he wanted to sell to Henry Ford, and he parked it on the railway outside of Henry Ford's office, and he named it the Henry Ford, right? It was like the Henry Ford, just big letters on the side of it. He named the locomotive after Henry Ford. And I may have a name wrong in there, but I read about this story, and we called this little plastic gauge that we created together as our company, we called it the Warren gauge. It was named after the top supervisor adjuster person at the company that was part of the team. And it was at that moment when people in their company started calling it the Warren gauge. That was the moment when people started adopting it. And when he was out there promoting it, it was his idea. Right? It was no longer about the statistics. It was no longer about the math. It was, hey, this is the Warren gauge. And when people started calling it that, it started just spreading like crazy, because he was engaged and he was excited about sharing it. If I would have called it the Ryan gauge, nobody would have used it, right?
Yeah. So let me ask something real practical. As a marketing guy, I always try to distill things down to, you know, just kind of simple things. When people bring you on board, what is the tangible thing that happens to their business?
Yeah, when people bring me on board, we very quickly assess and identify key gaps in that intersection of people and process. And what happens is they may need some coaching for some of the people. They may need some coaching and help. We work on workflow automations and how do we eliminate the need for handoffs. And most recently, we started even integrating generative AI so they get an AI readiness assessment, essentially. And we start looking at their processes and where can AI enhance what their people are doing, the processes and the workflow automations that are happening, and enhance it even further with technology. So we're doing a roadmap exercise at the beginning, an assessment and roadmap that leads to those three things.
Excellent. Now, if somebody wants to reach out to you, how do they find you?
Yeah, the best way, I'm on LinkedIn, Ryan C. Weiss. So I put my middle initial in there. Part of the reason I do that is I know who the spammers are, because they'll say, "Dear Ryan C." and all the reach out messages. And I know that that's coming from a bot, not from a human. So if you connect with me, Ryan C. Weiss on LinkedIn, or if you want to check out our company, it's epsoptics.com.
Ryan, this has been so interesting. Thank you for coming on Leaders and Legacies.
Thanks for having me, Craig. I appreciate it.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show. It means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.